Okay. So I wanted to talk about a couple of things, an attempt to build bridges between them. Initially, I wanted to share thoughts and notes on an ongoing conversation around infrastructure, how I came to it, what I've learned, and how this shapes the things I'm collectively attempting to build. I haven't spoken about this before in an art context. I've kind of been nervous to do so. A lot of this work is really dear to me and has to date represented a sort of flag in the ground for how I would like the world to look in the next 20 years. It makes me nervous to share this in an art world context because I think the art world has a habit of breaking things and bringing unconstructive polemics to the table. I also worry that this might make me seem a bit odd, but some of this stuff feels more solid and might be useful for a lot of the conversations that are emerging in the present moment. And it feels like maybe this is the right time to talk about it. So I wanted to start with stacktivism. It's a term coined by my friend Jay Springett, who I've lifted a bunch of slides from. Stacktivism aims to frame a conversation that many people are having in this conversation, in this moment. It's a hashtag, not a movement, and it's a simple way of collating and expanding the conversation. Stacktivism posits that we cannot have a conversation about something whilst it remains unseen. This idea is derived from Benjamin Bratton's forthcoming book and work on the idea of the stack. Stacktivism attempts to politicize this thinking by asking the question, who controls the means of not dying? Which is sometimes reframed as who controls the stack. Both myself, Jay, and probably a lot of other people arrived at these sorts of questions through the work of Vinay Gupta, and in particular his work on SCIM, Simple Critical Infrastructure Mapping. This conceptual tool was initially developed as part of Gupta's work for the Pentagon on the Star Tides project, which was primarily concerned with disaster relief and decentralizing infrastructure in developing countries. It's a tool that makes you consider and allows you to map the infrastructure that prevents you from not dying, and then begin to think about how you might decentralize it in order to prevent your government or a natural disaster killing you. This was taught to me in a building I was squatting with my friends in Mayfair in London in 2008. At that time, we were beginning to realize the limits and constrictions that a lot of the buildings that we were occupying were having. First of all, that was kind of like cold water, but then we started moving to buildings that didn't have any electricity or plumbing and stuff like that, so it was kind of complicated. The lesson that Vinay Gupta gave me in this kind of fundamentally broke my model of how you might realize political change. So this is SCIM, and sometimes it's referred to as the dartboard of death. And these are the six ways you might die: illness, injury, too hot, too cold, hunger, or thirst. The idea is that you place yourself at the center of a series of concentric circles that define your geography, and then you attempt to map the infrastructure that keeps you alive within the present moment. So if we were going to do it in this building, we might say, how do the lights turn on? Are they LED? Can we replace them with batteries? Are they connected to the main grid? Where does the water come from? A lot of this information you can begin to map online, but it's quite a useful thing to do. Maybe. when you combine SCIM with the idea of the stack, it begins with a desire to have a deeper understanding of like the interconnected nature of existing infrastructure. It begins to get pretty complicated. Jay, through the lens of stacktivism, suggests, though, see the invisible, understand the infrastructure, and then do something about it, which I think summarizes a fairly good starting point. Since SCIM and stacktivism, some other interesting ideas have been brought to the table, including Paul Graham Raven's infrastructure fiction. I don't think I have enough time to go into this in much depth, but he has two really good talks online. But in short, it's a call to action to go beyond the romantic but interesting practice of design fictions and start to write fiction about the gritty underside of infrastructure that keeps us alive, but also powers the gadgets that make the world fun. In making this argument, he presents two examples focused on infrastructure that might begin to allow us to start thinking in this way. The first is the idea that for most of us, our existing relationship to infrastructure begins and ends at the wall in our house. That without having something to plug into, most of our objects are essentially useless. So why hide it? Jay echoes this in the phrase tap, turn, flush, based on the idea that these are the only kinds of interactions that you have with infrastructure these days. But is just seeing this stuff enough when it turns out to be someone else's problem? Paul Graham Raven goes a second step in diagnosing the basic issue with existing infrastructure by referencing Douglas Adams' Life, the Universe, and Everything, in which Arthur Dent and Ford Prefect are watching a test match at Lord's when a spaceship lands on the ground in the middle of an oval. The only people who notice are Ford and Arthur, because the spaceship is protected by something called someone else's problem field, whose inventor realized that while making something invisible is incredibly difficult, making something to appear to be someone else's problem is very, very easy. Before we get to the bit where we talk about how how to make this your problem, I'd like to focus on the things that might motivate you in doing so. Visibility, awareness, or transparency simply aren't enough in the present moment, and in recent years we've had some hard lessons in the reality of that fact. Making something evident, real, concrete, or visible doesn't seem to change much. It just makes the NSA's job more frustrating and allows the people that were told they're crazy conspiracists to breathe a sigh of relief upon finding out they weren't crazy and actually they were right. So if just revealing the horror of the current moment isn't enough, what is? It's not just that the truth about governments and corporations is being made visible in this moment. In some ways, we might look back on WikiLeaks and Snowden as a byproduct of new ways of working and approaches to collaboration. Because the hacker movement isn't just revealing and making evident the work of the state, it's building things too. It's built currencies and ways to exchange products that challenge notions of intellectual property and property rights. In Hitto Steil's most recent text for eFlux, Too Much World Is the Internet Dead?, she closes by asking if we can challenge and uproot property relations with files and uproot property relations of files and services with an undead internet. If we can do that, why can't we also extend this into the realm of private property? Which is a fair point, but it's also one that I think many people are already beginning to make moves on. Hackerspaces began to spread all over the world. We now have hundreds of them in Europe, North America, and everywhere else. And I think they might be the first example of an open source ideology being applied at scale for the creation of a vast network of spaces. The argument for this is that hackerspaces' ability to spread is predicated on the idea of pattern languages. A basic pattern language is the ability to transcribe an experience for a series of steps, and they're particularly good at storing something that networks classically haven't been very good at storing, which is tacit knowledge. The things you could store is the way that you design this table, the decision-making process that you use, the way that you turn the electricity on in the building. And for the last 5 or 6 years, these have been used by hackerspaces so that in a specific context, you have the ability to create a new space with the components of all the other hackerspaces that make sense, and then share your pattern languages for the extra things that you learn on top. This is an entirely new way of building and distributing, predicated on making as much of the process as possible visible, but still this is just the nuts and bolts. As great as hackerspaces are, they still serve a fixed interest and fail at times to go beyond much more than a hobby space. They hack existing systems in order to establish a different kind of space in ones that surround them, but they don't fundamentally attempt to change that system directly, although arguably their growth may have that effect. In addition to hackerspaces kind of spreading, we have things like crowdfunding, and soon we have crowdfunding equity. If they ever figure out what the legal model is that you can span it across continents, it will probably be global governance. But before that, I think there's a set of things we might be able to combine with hackerspaces if you turn that idea on its head. One of which would be, if NGOs, organizations, and companies are attempting to affect change and reshape law and policy, it might be more interesting to collectively crowdfund a policy report or a legal document that enables lots of other people to do it, so no one has to create a company in order to get there first. Okay, that's all nice and good, but it was something of a preamble to build the foundations in order to begin to talk about something I've been a part of for the past 2 years, in the hope that it might shed light on its potential and what it looks like to integrate transparent and generous approaches into the birth of a network, organization, or idea. So this is EdgeRiders. I'm going to try and really quickly explain what EdgeRiders is. The Council of Europe wanted a policy report on youth transition in times of crisis. What they got was a distributed think tank with over 1,000 people online having a conversation talking about their personal experience of trying to exist at the edges of society. It produced a lovely policy report, which will probably influence nothing, but they did manage to bring 250 strange people to Strasbourg to sit in the Council of Europe and have a conversation with diplomats and policymakers with a Twitter wall in the background. Now, these 250 people with people like Telecomics, WikiLeaks, various activists, squatters, social innovators, policy people, engineers, farmers, essentially the people living on the edge. In that moment, people realised that the institution, the Council of Europe or other existing institutions, wasn't going to be able to help them, but in the last 50 years has done quite a lot in Europe in order to sustain no war, no borders, etc. So the basic aim of EdgeRiders is to try and build what's necessary to support a network of committed individuals working at the edge of society to continue working and surviving. It's based on an ethos. The person who knows what to do next leads. The person who makes the suggestion does the work, and no one can say no. One thing that's heavily embedded into EdgeRiders is everything happens on the platform. That means all the budgets are there, all the decision making, the corporate shell that we've created since migrating out of the Council of Europe. This leads to a very weird scenario in which there are some side effects that can be difficult to stomach, like having your leadership and general management of a project called into question for everyone to see. But this is done in order to reduce wasting time or pointless squabbling and concealed frustration. This is an instance on Sunday when I got called out for having poor leadership. But it also doesn't prevent people claiming that you're not being transparent enough. What we realised a year ago was that having an online platform, supporting the development of projects and attempting to use a crowdsourced approach to influencing policy simply isn't good enough in the terms of the kind of change that we're attempting to create. And with that, we birthed Unmonastery. And because this is a 10-minute talk, I'm going to explain it really quickly. Unmonastery attempts to collapse the idea of pattern languages for replication, resilience and decentralised infrastructure, a notion of liquid law, transparent decision-making, all cited within a geographically based model that is focused on tackling four problems. Large numbers of empty and disused housing throughout Europe, austerity in the rollback of state services, high unemployment, particularly among young and highly skilled individuals, and brain drain from small towns and cities throughout Europe and the world. In order to create a support structure for a network of individuals traveling across Europe, building and confronting the challenges of small towns and cities. Oh, and lastly, but probably most importantly, it's done on the basis of a re-examination of what monastic principles might mean in a contemporary sense based on a 200-year trajectory. Because something happened in the 8th or 9th century from the transition of the oral tradition of passing on the rule to being written down that's super problematic and complicated, but probably quite relevant to the present moment. And I think that's all I've got to say on transparency. Thank you.